Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you just knew a promise couldn't be kept?
Yeah, I think we've all been there.
Well, today we're going to dive deep into a West Virginia case, Waddy v. Riggleman,
Okay.
that really grapples with this question.
Interesting.
And this one's full of crucial lessons for you future lawyers out there, I promise.
Yeah, this case really offers a really valuable, I guess, lens to look at, the limits of contractual obligations. Who bears the burden when unforeseen challenges arise? So, we're going to dissect a land sale gone wrong and the legal principles at play. I think they have really broad implications for just about everybody.
So let's get right into it. At the heart of our deep dive today
Okay.
is this case, Waddy v. Riggleman,
Yeah.
and we'll be looking at a land sale contract, the doctrine of impracticability.
Yeah.
That is, when a contract can't be kept,
Right.
and the importance of sticking to those contractual commitments.
Yeah, and the scenario itself is actually pretty relatable, right? Just imagine you have a contract for land and the seller is obligated to deliver a clear title, right? Free of any liens or encumbrances. And in this case, the sellers, the Rigglemans, they ran into some trouble clearing those liens, and this led to a whole legal battle with the buyer, Mr. Waddy.
And what's so interesting about this case is the initial ruling at the circuit court actually favored the sellers. But that wasn't the end of it, was it?
No, not at all. The Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia actually stepped in and reversed that initial decision.
So today, our mission is to really get under the hood of this case.
Right.
We want to understand when a defense of impracticability actually works, how courts interpret critical contract terms, and why your diligence as a lawyer is so important.
Yeah.
And this isn't just some theory. This is practical stuff that you're going to face in your practice.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so the circuit court, they actually bought this argument of impossibility from the Riggleman's. But the appellate court saw it very differently, and it really centers around this idea of impracticability. But before we get into that, let's lay the groundwork a little bit. Can you tell us about the contract, the original deal here?
Yeah, so back in July of 2002, Mr. Waddy, he agreed to purchase a 30-acre piece of land from the Rigglemans for $22,500. Now, this sounds pretty straightforward, but there was a really critical condition. The Rigglemans, they were obligated to give the land with a clear title. That means no outstanding language, no encumbrances. They were also responsible for all those expenses to clear the title. And, this is a great example of how seemingly standard language becomes like the center of the entire dispute, highlighting that even standard contractual language has immense weight.
So, I mean, in a land sale, clear title, that's pretty fundamental.
Exactly, yeah. And so the initial closing date, it was set for September 5th, 2002. However, as often happens, that deadline, it wasn't set in stone. So they agreed to extensions, and they even discussed, it's interesting, they even discussed expanding the acreage that Mr. Waddy was going to buy.
So more land and more time, presumably, to get
Yeah,
everything.
to get everything squared away. But even with all this extra time and the bigger piece of land, the Rigglemans just couldn't secure those releases for the deeds of trust that were on the property, clouding the title. And so by that final extended closing date, the title was still not clear.
And so then what
So
happens
then the
then?
Rigglemans, they informed Mr. Waddy that they weren't going to go through with the sale. And you can imagine Mr. Waddy at this point, he's probably invested a lot of time, resources,
Of course,
that he's not pleased.
So at this point, he decides to take legal action.
Yes.
What was he asking the court to do?
Yeah. So Mr. Waddy, he filed a lawsuit seeking specific performance of the contract. So that's where the buyer asked the court to essentially force the seller to go through with the sale. So he didn't want, just damages or anything. He wanted the land. And he named the Rigglemans as defendants, as well as some other parties that were likely connected to these LinkedIns.
Okay, so the case ends up in the Circuit Court of Grant County. And as we said, the initial ruling was a directed verdict in favor of the Riggleman's.
Okay.
And for listeners who might not be familiar with this term, a directed verdict basically means the judge decided the case before it even got to the jury.
Right.
What was the lower court's reasoning for this?
So the circuit court essentially sided with the Rigglemans, and they focused on two main points. First, they said that time was of the essence in this contract. And second, they decided that obtaining a clear title that was impossible, and that this impossibility It excused the Riggleman's from their obligation to sell.
Wow. I mean, impossible. That sounds pretty absolute in a legal context. What led them to that conclusion?
Well, you know, the specifics aren't spelled out in like super detail in the sources.
Right.
But it's reasonable to assume that the Riggleman's, they probably argued that the financial cost,
yeah,
or even just the complexity of getting those releases,
yeah,
that it was basically impossible for them to deliver that clean title,
right,
in that time frame, even with the extensions.
Wow.
And the circuit court, they seem to have accepted this argument.
And so it wasn't just about letting the Riggleman's off the hook. They also addressed the money that Mr. Waddy had already put forward.
Right.
Right.
So the circuit court, they actually ordered the Riggleman's to refund Mr. Waddy's $4,000 deposit.
Yeah.
And also the $1,200 that he had contributed for the survey costs.
Okay.
So it looked like the Riggleman's, they had gotten out of the contract.
Yeah. But as we know, this wasn't the final word. So the case then goes to the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia,
yeah,
and they come to a very different conclusion.
Yeah, they really did. So the appellate court, they reviewed the circuit court's decision,
right,
and in the end, they reversed it.
Yeah.
And this reversal really comes down to this key legal principle.
Yeah.
The doctrine of impracticability.
Okay, so this is this doctrine of impracticability. This is really the heart of the matter.
Yes.
For our listeners, you know, especially those who are hearing this for the first time, can you explain what this doctrine is all about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you can think of the doctrine of impracticability as like a legal escape hatch.
Okay.
But it's a very, very narrow one.
Okay.
Okay, so it allows a party to be excused from their contractual obligations if something unforeseen happens.
Right.
That makes performing those obligations like really, really difficult, or in some cases, straight up impossible.
Yeah.
But here's the catch, and this is super important. The bar for claiming impracticability, it's set super high.
Yeah.
It's not just about something becoming like more expensive or inconvenient.
Right.
It has to be a really big and truly unexpected obstacle. So it's not like saying, oh, I couldn't find the right paint color. It's more like the paint factory burned down.
Okay, so it's not just a hurdle. It's like a major roadblock.
Exactly, exactly.
That couldn't have been really seen coming.
Right.
And in this case, the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals used a specific test.
Yes.
To decide if the Riggleman's could use this doctrine.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. They adopted this four-part test that you have to meet to claim impracticability.
Okay, so what's the four-part test?
Okay, so first, something has to have happened that made it like truly impracticable,
okay,
to perform.
Right.
Second, the fact that that event didn't happen, that has to have been like a basic assumption,
okay,
when you made the contract.
Yeah.
So you can think of a basic assumption, like the fundamental understandings, like unspoken understandings that both parties rely on.
Right.
So in a typical land sale, you know, a clear title, that's like a basic assumption.
Absolutely.
You kind of just assume that that's going to be there.
Right.
Third, the impracticability. It has to have happened without the fault of the party that's trying to get out of the contract.
Okay.
And then finally, that party can't have agreed to perform despite, you know, the possibility of this problem coming up.
Okay, four big hurdles.
Yes.
So where did the Riggleman stumble in trying to meet this test?
Yeah, so the court found that they basically failed on the third part of the test, the one about the impracticability happening without their fault.
Okay.
So the court basically said that those releases, they could have been obtained,
right,
if they put in reasonable effort,
right,
in the time they had.
Okay.
Which was, remember, they had those extensions. It wasn't like a short amount of time.
Right, right. So it wasn't some big, like, external, uncontrollable event.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the court was really emphasizing that you can't use your own inaction or neglect,
right,
as a valid excuse.
Okay.
There's actually a quote from the case. It says, "A party cannot plead inability caused by its own neglect as an excuse." It's a very clear statement.
Yeah.
You're responsible for what you do in a contract.
Right.
So the court was basically saying, you know, you, the Riggleman's, you had this duty to deliver a clear title.
Right.
And you couldn't do it. And it seems like it was because you just didn't try hard enough.
Right.
You can't claim a possibility when you didn't even try to meet it.
Right. And this really goes back to that initial obligation in the contract.
Exactly.
To provide a clear title.
Yes. The court really reinforced that this was clearly spelled out in the contract.
Yeah.
And you can't just get around that.
Right.
By saying, oh, it's impossible.
Yeah.
Now, if they had you know, exhausted all their options
right.
and still failed, then maybe their argument would have worked.
Okay.
But that's not what happened here.
Right, right. Now, the circuit court also said that time was of the essence in this contract.
Yeah.
What did the appellate court think about that?
So the Supreme Court of Appeals, they actually disagreed with that. They said that even if time was of the essence,
right,
which, by the way, wasn't really established,
okay,
it still wouldn't let the sellers get out of clearing the title.
Right.
Like, that was their job.
So even with those strict deadlines, yeah, they still had that obligation to get that clear title.
Exactly. The court was basically saying that, yeah, time is important,
right,
but you still have to do what you promised to do, especially when it seems like you didn't meet those deadlines because of your own inaction.
Right, right.
They couldn't use the ticking clock as an excuse.
That makes sense. Now, what about this other part of the appeal, the dismissal of Mr. Waddy's claims against C. Fred Hours and Carol A. Hours?
Oh, yeah. So the Supreme Court, they also addressed that.
Okay.
And they ruled that the circuit court dismissing those claims was premature.
Okay.
They said that those claims should be reinstated and sent back for more legal action.
Wow.
And, you know, the specifics of those claims, they aren't really the focus of our discussion today on impracticability. But it is an important procedural point.
Mm.
It suggests that maybe there were other parties involved in these title issues, and the appellate court thought Mr. Waddy should have the chance to go after them too.
Wow. So a complete reversal of the lower court's decision.
Yes.
And back, it goes for more legal wrangling.
Yeah.
This case seems full of really important lessons, especially for those of us, you know, going into law.
Yeah.
What are the key takeaways for our listeners?
There are so many. So first, you know, this case really shows how important it is to have clear and unambiguous terms in your contract, especially when you're talking about something as fundamental as clearing title in real estate.
Right, right.
And the court even said, where the terms of a contract are clear and unambiguous, they must be applied and not construed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the exact words you use, they really matter. So try to be clear and avoid leaving any room for interpretation.
Absolutely. Leaving any room for that ambiguity can lead to some really big legal battles.
Absolutely, yeah.
What's another key lesson here?
Well, the case also really highlights how crucial diligence is.
Okay.
When it comes to, you know, doing what you're supposed to do in a contract.
Right.
And the court said that if you're claiming impossibility, you have to show that you did virtually every action within its powers to perform.
Wow.
It's a really telling statement.
Yeah.
So basically, a passive approach, it's not going to work.
Right.
If you want to argue that you couldn't fulfill your obligations.
So being proactive.
Yes.
And having documentation of those efforts.
Exactly. Super important.
Really important.
Yeah. And another point is really understanding the limitations of that impracticability defense.
Okay.
This case is a great example of how you can't use it to just get out of a contract because it's too hard or too expensive.
Right.
The court said, and I quote, "Unforeseen difficulties, however great, will not excuse performance."
Oh, wow.
So it really has to be something exceptional and unexpected that's completely out of your control. That's an important distinction to remember.
Yeah, it's not just about things being difficult.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, one other thing. This wasn't the main focus of the court's decision, but the fact that John Ars, he represented both Mr. Waddy and the Riggelmans.
Oh, wow.
In this deal, it does raise some ethical questions.
Yeah.
Even though the court didn't really go into them in this ruling.
Right.
It's just a good reminder for all you future lawyers about how important it is to avoid conflicts of interest when you're representing people.
Absolutely. Definitely something to think about
as
we go forward in our careers.
Yeah.
Now, what about the procedural part of the appeal itself?
Okay, so this case also emphasizes something called the appellate court's de novo review standard.
Okay.
Specifically, for directed verdicts in bench trials.
Okay.
So this basically means that when an appellate court reviews a directed verdict from a judge, they don't give special weight to what that trial court decided. They look at the legal issues fresh, like they were the first ones deciding.
Okay.
This is important to understand in the appeals process.
So to sum it all up, the big lessons from Waddy v. Riggelman, the bar for claiming impracticability, it's super high.
Yeah.
Clearly written contracts are essential.
Absolutely.
And showing you really trying to meet those obligations.
Yes.
That's non-negotiable.
Right.
And the court's not going to help you if you broke the contract because of your own actions.
Yeah. The Riggleman's, they learned this the hard way.
Yeah.
They didn't do enough to clear that title,
right,
which was their job.
Right.
And that's what led to the court overturning that first ruling.
So as you continue your legal studies,
yes,
and eventually get out there and practice,
yeah,
think about this. What can your clients do,
right,
to avoid ever having to say it was impossible?
Yeah.
Waddy v. Riggleman, this case, it reminds us that really trying hard,
yeah,
to do what you said you would do in a contract, that's often the difference between success and a really costly legal mess.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive. We'll see you next time.
Okay, great.